Welcome once again to the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. We are crafting a bold vision for America here, and I have a guest with me who's actually been on before, but it's been a long time, and his name is Rod Martin. He has been on the podcast before to talk about Southern Baptist related stuff, which is why many of you probably know him and that name might ring a bell. But lately, especially since Trump's election, Rod has been involved in trying to explain the world, foreign policy, domestic policy, international stuff to Christians and conservatives. And if you want to know more about what he's doing, you can go to rodmartin.org. You can find his Substack and I'm assuming his investment stuff and whatever else, social media links. So check that out. But without further ado, Rod Martin, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So we can take this in a lot of different directions, but I wanted to start with just a basic question for people who might have seen you on my show a few years ago, and now you're focused on other things. What happened? Did something in your life change, or did you just decide, I want to talk about more national, international stuff? Because before, maybe we were just seeing a version of you, but you were more focused on SBC stuff, I thought, and then investment. Now you're doing a lot of commentary. I see you on shows all the time talking about Iran and that kind of thing.
Well, my day job was, is, and remains CEO of Martin Capital. So we are deeply involved in a bunch of tech startups and things like that. I was one of the early guys at PayPal. You know about that. And we do some really nifty stuff, but it is very much impacted by global events. So we analyze what's going on in the world pretty carefully. And when Trump came back into office, I've been writing off and on for 30 years. It's not like it's a new thing. But with the technologies we have now, the workload is much lighter. You know, when I had a WordPress site 10 years ago, I spent 70% of my time doing technical junk instead of writing, which was just ridiculous. But Trump comes back in, Substack exists, all these automation tools exist. I said, I'm just going to jump in because I understand Donald Trump. I've been following this guy. I wasn't for him in 2016 until my guys all washed out. I'm friends with Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee, so I was for them. But then they wash out and it's Trump and versus Hillary. It's kind of a no-brainer. We've got to be for Trump. I don't know what we're going to get for sure, but here we go. Well, I should have known better, because what I did know was a lot of the things being said about him were wrong. He has a paper trail, you know, going back decades. I mean, I started seeing this guy on TV when I was a teenager. And, you know, he wrote his first book in 87, and he wrote his second book in 90, and he wrote his third book in 97, and then he wrote 10 more books, and he did The Apprentice for 10 or 15 years. And he's told you who he is. I mean, and even on the political stuff, people lost track of that because that wasn't the focus until he became a candidate. So everybody forgot he'd done it. But you'll see these clips, like this week, there was a clip Glenn Beck shared of him arguing with Barbara Walters in 1987 about Iran. And he's just basically laying out what he's doing today in 1987. You know, if you read the last chapter of Art of the Comeback in 1997, it's all about what would I do if I were president? And the only thing that's meaningfully changed from 1997 is that in 2011, he became pro-life. And that's really the only sea change in his thinking. Everything else has been consistent. So once you realize that, the roadmap's actually pretty clear. And I knew that nobody was really in a position to bring that exact perspective on it except just a handful of people, and certainly not with a positive view of what's possible. So my thesis, plain and simple, 90 years ago, FDR carried out what was tantamount to a silent coup. And he probably didn't think about it that way. I doubt anybody who was helping him implement it thought about it that way, but they did know what they were doing. And what they were doing was they were transferring a massive amount of constitutional executive power to unelected bureaucracies that weren't subject to firing. So Democrats populate all those agencies in the 30s. They have legislative, executive, and judicial authority. They perpetuate themselves. They hire their own successors. And you've got 2.8 million Democrats running the government at all times for almost a century. And it really doesn't matter who the president is because he's one guy. And he gets to appoint about 5,000 guys versus 2.8 million. So this is why elections happen and nothing seems to change a lot of the time. This is also why they hate Donald Trump, because he understood that well enough to actually hack at it with a machete. And it's just driving them crazy because it completely upsets a century-old apple cart that more than a few rhinos are involved in, too. Don't get me wrong. But this is all about a leftist agenda permanently pushed on the American people through the force of law. And Trump is, as I said, hacking at that. He's also hacking at the imbalances we have in trade and our alliances, which are becoming more manifest by the day. The aim, of course, isn't isolationism. Trump has never been an isolationist. Trump believes that everybody ought to pay their fair share and carry their own weight. It is ridiculous that Germany would train its army with broomsticks because they won't fork over for rifles. It's absurd. When the German defense minister tells us that there's no point in Europe helping escort its own oil out of the Strait of Hormuz to Europe for Europe's use, because what can a handful of European frigates do compared to the mighty U.S. Navy? Well, okay, you just gave me a reason to not pay for your defense anymore, because you are a top-ranked economy who will not defend yourself, hectors us about Ukraine, and then sends twice as much money to Russia for energy imports that you should have bought from the United States than you send in aid to Ukraine. And we're the bad guy. So Trump has a very realist view of this. I would call it a moral realist view in the same vein as Ronald Reagan. The communication styles kind of obscure that. He sounds really different from Reagan, but the underlying policy positions are very, very similar. And it's just a fascinating time. So anyway, very long story short, I started writing about this pretty heavily after the election in 24. And on Inauguration Day, I had a piece go viral. We got like 20 million views in 18 hours. It was just absurd. My ex exploded to about 300,000. We've got tens of thousands of subscribers at rodmartin.org for what Fox News calls absolutely phenomenal geopolitical analysis. So we're pretty happy with that. And so that's getting a lot of attention. But before I hush, I'll just say this. I was on Cross Politic last night talking about the SBC. They just dropped a Senate doc here a week or two ago on the obscenity of how the sex abuse investigation was conducted, the conflicts of interest that Rachel Denhollander had, the fact that Guidepost Solutions, which investigated the whole thing, turns out they weren't even licensed. And failing to be licensed is actually a criminal offense. I mean, everything about this was whack. And so I encourage everybody to go to Cross Politic and watch the new Senate doc and our interview last night.
That's great. There's so many directions we could take this in, and I'd like to save the SBC stuff for last if we get to it. You sound to me like you maybe saw something on the horizon, and you wanted to defend Trump because you might have seen not just that, there's the obvious cast of characters against him. I mean, he almost got assassinated. He was, there's a mugshot of him. But did you see this sort of on the social media right, the knives coming out for him? Did you sense that and say, I want to get ahead of that and start explaining and defending Trump?
I'm surprised by Tucker and some of those guys. But yes, in general, certainly, because if you'll recall, in the first term, we had probably more opposition in some respects from the Republicans than the Democrats when Trump was trying to do things that were manifestly good, like repeal Obamacare. Well, it wasn't the Democrats who stopped it, although they all voted to stop it. It was John McCain and a handful of Republicans. And there were just item after item after item like that. you know, Bob Mueller technically was a Republican. Jim Comey, who actually was taught critical theory in college by Marcuse, you know, he's technically a Republican. And so you've got all these rhinos who have infested the party for decades, and we've been fighting that forever. In another incarnation, I was president of the National Federation of Republican Assemblies, and our slogan was, we're the Republican wing of the Republican Party. You know, we're always trying to fight insurgencies. And this is that. We're trying at rodmartin.org, and I say we because I've got guest writers, and we've got a bunch of great people involved in that. We're trying to describe the big picture of what Trump is trying to accomplish, which he will not accomplish in his 4 years. It will not be done. But leaning a bit on Neil Howe's thesis about the fourth turning, I feel like we're at an inflection point where the country's going to flip really hard one direction or another. I felt that way before I read Neil and got to know him. And it just seems very, very clear that everything is being decided as we speak. Not today, not this year, but over the next few, not many, few. So when people say, you know, this is the most important election of our lifetime, well, I've been hearing that all my life, but actually right now it's true. And I am pleased to say that we have a little progress in the SBC. We have a little, not a lot, but some. You know, we have a little progress on a lot of fronts, but what Trump's accomplishing is really quite remarkable.
Let's talk a little bit about the online world just for a moment. I agree with you. We're in a point of decision and changes. And I was reading something yesterday about how last year there people were actually seceding from online. Essentially, they were saying, I don't want to be on social media anymore. A lot of content creators are quitting, like more lower level content creators. I don't know if you remember Tim Pool. He almost quit last December. He said, Candace Owens is basically ruining me. Like, I've got these threats. And I think a lot of people are wondering, is this worth it? Obviously, you think it is because you're involved on the online world. But I do wonder at times, okay, how much of this is real? When you start seeing polls about how Republicans, MAGA, and Americans in general feel about the Iran conflict and Trump's job there, and then it doesn't seem to match at all what you're seeing online. I just wonder what's going on there. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, let's start with it doesn't reflect reality. We have poll after poll after poll after poll over the last 4 weeks on where people are on the war. So we know a little bit about this. And we can look at it from a composite standpoint, because you've got everything from John McLaughlin, who's clearly in our camp, and he does polls for the president. You've got Rasmussen. You've got Harvard Harris yesterday. You've got NBC and CNN. So you've got a bunch of different matrices through which to look at this.
And last week you had CPAC.
Yes, and the CPAC straw poll is more meaningful than normal because we were told on X that it was a Groiper convention. Well, that's kind of odd because something like 96 or 98% of them were supporting the president. So doesn't sound like a Tucker-friendly audience to me.
And Vance and Rubio and the action. Right.
Well, and some of the most enthusiastic crowd applause was for Reza Pahlavi, who is just really, I think, an amazing guy. I wish he were a believer. We need a witness to Reza Pahlavi, duh. But, you know, we've got Iranian government data that says that 54% of Iranians are non-religious. You know, Islam is dying in Iran, and you can thank the Ayatollah for that. So thank you, Ayatollah, wherever you are burning in hell. And, you know, we have government data from Iran saying that in the last 10 years, 50 of 75,000 mosques in Iran have closed. That's an enormous opportunity for the gospel. That's an enormous opportunity for freedom, really. And so, you know, the CPAC is cheering Reza Pahlavi. Well, that's not the narrative you hear from Candace Owens or Nick Fuentes. And I would say, you know, I don't know these people's hearts. I don't know where they're coming from. But I know this, we had a revival breaking out when Charlie died. And it was really extraordinary for a brief moment. And then this woman who got fired by Charlie, and then Charlie married this pretty blonde girl who isn't Candace, and all of a sudden she's pretending after he's dead, but not before, to be his best friend and smear literally everybody around him, with the central focus of that being the girl who did marry him. Okay, I think I've seen this play. I don't think this has a lot to do with ideology. And that doesn't account for Tucker. That doesn't account for Fuentes. That doesn't account for a lot of these people. But I think it very much accounts for Candace. And they are talking to themselves. Again, all those polls across, you know, left, right, center, whatever, they all show enormous support, not just among MAGA, self-identified, which is off the chart, but Trump 2024 voters. So now you're talking about MAGA, other Republicans, and lots of independents. And their support for the president here hasn't wavered. So, yeah, he's got some bad numbers in general, but duh. I mean, so does every president at this point in his term. That's not new. Trump's numbers are better than Biden's at this point in Biden's term and slightly worse than Obama's at this point in Obama's second term. So it's almost identical. And on the war, the Harvard-Harris poll I saw yesterday morning has support in the broader population, so likely voters, support for the war at about 54%, which when you watch CNN and see how most people are getting their news is really remarkable, because, you know, CNN would have you believe that the Iranians are marching on Philadelphia this week.
That's funny. Let's talk about the war just for a moment. So start to finish. Start of it, you were writing articles. I think you wrote an article about how this is justifiable using the Barbary Pirates example. Which I was more critical of that. I don't like when we go to war and Congress doesn't declare the war, because I see the Barbary Pirates more as defensive action. But in the grand scheme of things, this is what I wrestle with. And maybe this is what you can weigh in on and help my audience who wrestles with this, too. We have bases all over the world. We're in debt. I don't want to spend money. I don't want wars. I don't, anything that costs money. I really just don't want to do it, because I'm looking at this national debt going up and up. And this is a national security issue. At the same time, I know that our dollar is strong, partially because we're all over the world. And I don't want to lose American hegemony in these other places. And I know China and Russia they have their eye on the Middle East. And so, what's the, in Rod Martin's mind, Do you just embrace the empire and say the strong executive and the empire model is good going forward? Do you try to roll it back? What do you think the best solution is here for America, and especially Americans concerned about debt?
Well, let's define a couple terms. You know, first, hegemony is not empire. And you were exactly right to speak of American hegemony. Hegemony is first among equals. We get that word, of course, from the Greeks. The Amphictyonic League, which James Madison never tired of talking about, and I'm sure all his peers in Philadelphia got really sick of that. The Amphictyonic League was the Athenian alliance arrayed against Sparta, and they were all independent, but Athens was much more powerful than all the others, so it got to call the shots, and that's really where America is. In the world order that we exist in, you really get two choices. You get American hegemony or you get Chinese hegemony. It's one or the other. And there's really no question that the American version is better, partly because I live here, but also partly because we actually believe in freedom. We may not be as consistent about it as I would like. We're certainly not as Christian a nation as I would prefer, but we're infinitely superior to a Chinese communist regime that wishes to impose totalitarianism on everything it can touch. So given that reality, America has always been a trading nation. We have all, you mentioned the Barbary Pirates. How did that come about? Well, because we're a nation of traders. We were always a nation of sea captains going out and finding new markets and selling American stuff there and bringing back exotic imports. And And that's a lot of how we built our wealth, in very much the same way that the British did, but we outlasted the British. And so here we are. And you can't make that all go away. I mean, we're not dependent on anybody. We're briefly dependent on the Chinese for rare earths. We'll have that problem solved in another 3 to 4 years tops. That's not going to continue to be a big deal. But it is a big deal that we actually get to make sure that the seas are free, that commerce can proceed, that travelers can go places unmolested, and that American businesses get rich as a result of that. And an American business isn't Exxon. An American business is Conversations That Matter. An American business is rodmartin.org. You know, we're doing things that are affected by the global economy, and America has interests everywhere. So again, Donald Trump is not America only. Donald Trump is America first in that Athenian model from ancient times. And that's what's confusing some of these guys. They heard isolationism. Donald Trump has built skyscrapers literally all over the world. He is not an America-only guy. That's not who he is. But he's also not a neoconservative. And there is a crucial distinction there. The neoconservatives take liberal internationalism, which is Wilson and a lot of the Roosevelt people and the Democratic Party, you know, pretty much down the line for the last century or so. Liberal internationalism says that we should put what a Democrat thinks of as a moral consideration. And I say it that way because that frequently means transgenderism or abortion on demand. It doesn't mean what you mean by it. But moral considerations should go ahead of national interest. And we've seen a lot of pernicious behavior as a result of that. Neoconservatism doubles down on that. Neoconservatism takes the view that not only is that a good idea, but we should actually put American armies in foreign countries as long as it takes to remake them in our image. Neoconservatism is a messianic movement that has been highly destructive to this country over the last 25 years. And we really must stamp that out. What Trump is doing is this Reagan-esque model. It is reminiscent of the realism of Nixon and Kissinger, but it isn't all the way there. It's this idea that, yes, the moral matters, but there are limits to American power, and we should understand them well and only use American power in a way that serves American interests, even if that means that the world remains morally messy, because we aren't Jesus and we can't save them. They're going to continue to be sinners no matter how many American boots are on the ground. So we're going to do the best we can, and we're going to push toward better, and we're not going to overdo it. And that's been Trump's MO from the beginning.
I couldn't agree more with Trump not being a neoconservative and not being an isolationist. There is this category he's in, and it seems like people want to, right now, as we're speaking, push him into the neoconservative camp, that he got fooled, MAGA's betrayed everyone. I'm saying people online, some of the platforms you talked about. So maybe it'd be helpful at this point to get Rod Martin's opinion on Iran more directly. Cost-benefit analysis. Why did we go in? What did Netanyahu fool Trump into going in? Is Israel just making us do their dirty work for them? What exactly is going on there?
Well, Netanyahu had very little to do with it unless he was puppeting Donald Trump in 1980 and 1987 when he was saying the exact same thing on television that he's saying today. Iran is first and foremost, of course, just like Venezuela, just like Cuba, it's about Iran. You know, I don't want to lose track of that when I say, but in Trump world, everything is about China. It's not about Israel. It's about China. China is the great geopolitical nemesis of our time. Are they likely to nuke us? Probably not. But on the other hand, they've increased their strategic nuclear weapons force by about 600% over the last 10 years. So that's not nothing. That actually causes some real problems for our arms control agreements, you know, that have obviously been beneficial over the last 20 years. I'm not sure they ever were before that, but they actually have been more recently. And that really messes up the math on mutual assured destruction, because if China starts having, as they will by 2030, as many strategic nuclear weapons as Russia, now you always have the danger that one of the three powers might gang up with one of the other two powers, and that puts all three in an existentially dangerous position. So it's very possible that you could see just a monster nuclear arms race in the next decade that I'm really hoping we can avert. And I know Trump is paying attention to that, so I think we've got a shot at it. But that's part of what's going to happen. You won't get to a conclusion, but that's part of the discussion in the summit with Xi next month. So China is the center. What is the problem with China? Well, China wants global hegemony. And to be fair to them, they're not the Soviets. They don't actually want global empire. They want global hegemony. And they want all of those countries that are enthralled to them to be like them to the degree that they can bring that about over time. So that's not good. That's not a future you want. That's a future where, you know, they exterminate whole races and murder 65 million of their own people during the Cultural Revolution. And this is simply not acceptable. So you have two very different visions of the human future. One is American, one is communist, and the communists are doing everything they're in their power here at home to make the American version communist also. So Trump is fighting that, and Iran fits in it. Venezuela was a key source of Iranian, steeply discounted sanctioned oil. And this is something that most Americans haven't quite internalized yet. 40% of China's imported oil, and it absolutely depends on oil imports. It doesn't produce anywhere near enough to run its economy. We are self-sufficient to the degree we wish to be. We choose to import from Canada. We choose to import in California from the Middle East because they've made energy production nearly impossible on their side of the continent. But most of the country is self-sufficient. China isn't, and China can't be. So how is it propping up its economy, which is clearly spiraling? I mean, they're clearly having serious structural problems, and the government numbers are clearly false. And we see where this is headed based on the demographic collapse that's in progress as well. So Trump sees a country that is highly dependent on imports for energy, highly dependent on imports even for food, and we control all the choke points. So Trump has gone around and made sure we really control all the choke points. We now have everything he wanted in Panama. You know, we now have the Strait of Hormuz as soon as we just sweep the mines. And we're taking our time about that because he's playing a separate game with NATO. But, you know, we'll clear it when we clear it. We control Sunda. We control Malacca. We control Lombok. We control anything we choose to control. The U.S. Navy has no peer. And so in that matrix, Donald Trump wants to constrain our Chinese opponent sufficiently that they run out of money to be able to project power, invade Taiwan, invade Siberia, whatever they might choose to do. And in that matrix, you understand, Venezuela is sending them illegal sanctioned oil. Iran is sending them 90% of their foreign exports, illegal sanctioned oil. Russia is sending them a huge percentage of their illegal sanctioned oil. And China is benefiting from that by paying a steep discount for it. And that's helping prop up the Chinese economy. Donald Trump is making that go away. So on that geopolitical level, Iran is being taken off the board in part to keep China at peace and not let it be a threat.
Hey, it's John. I've been using Marsmen for a few months now, and I honestly can say that I feel pretty good. I'm not dragging through workouts. I'm not wiped out after chasing my little girl or handling stuff around the house. As a husband and a father, I take it seriously. I want to stay strong, energized, and capable for my family. Marsmen makes that easier. It's packed with 8 powerful, clinically dosed ingredients like Pongkat Ali, Chilajit, Fenugreek, Taurine, Zinc, Boron, Vitamin D, and Vitamin K that work together to support natural testosterone, energy, strength, and recovery. Most guys don't realize it until it hits them, but during the middle age years, you start to lose some of your testosterone. Right now, listeners get a great deal, 50% off for life, free shipping, free gifts, plus their 90-day higher T guarantee. Go to mengotomars.com and grab yours today, and don't forget to let them know that Conversations That Matter sent you. God bless.
To the United States militarily. Then, you know, Iran itself is the source of every armed conflict in the Middle East right now. So, again, taking this evil regime off the board, these people who actually actually execute women for getting raped, eliminating them, letting Iran be free is a boon to the world. It will certainly be a boon to the Middle East. The really crucial point there, Iran is the source of every armed conflict in the Middle East right now. All of them. I mean, they fund, direct, and arm every bad guy in the region. They are the source of the problem. If you cut off the head of this snake, it really does die. And it won't be perfect. And, you know, you'll still have Hezbollah stuff, and the Houthis will still shoot off some missiles while they still have some, you know, but eventually they run out of guns.
So I want a few Rod Martin predictions here for Americans who are concerned about debt. And I think many of them maybe don't understand or don't agree with the threat level you're describing. They think, man, I've heard my whole life about Iran, or I've heard that they're this close to a nuke and they never seem to get it. Why did we have to go in there? Predictions from Rod Martin about the outcome of all this. And you can take this any direction you want. Gas prices, they're going up, they're going down. And since we're doing this on April 1st, and I'm going to probably release it next Monday or Tuesday, I don't know if there'll be changes significant in that period, but you can tell us what you think of oil prices. Regime change, you think that's going to happen? Do you think boots on the ground is going to happen, even in the Strait of Hormuz? Where is this all going? What are the predictions?
Well, gas prices for me here in Florida are still better than they were under Biden. So I'm not overly concerned about that from a U.S. perspective. Again, we're self-sufficient in oil to the degree we wish to be. We are choosing to import a lot of Canadian oil and now a growing amount of Venezuelan oil, primarily to keep that Venezuelan oil from going to China. And we've got a bunch of refineries along the Gulf Coast that are optimized for this especially heavy crude that they have down there. So it all makes sense, and it's good for the future of Venezuela. They will eventually have a free election, and they will be Argentina, basically. But if you look at gas prices from an American perspective, really not that big a deal, and it'll come back down as soon as the war's over. As far as East Asia, it's catastrophic. They have gas lines all over China now. People are having to queue up to get a full tank, and Europe is going to feel the pain, too, which is part of the point Trump is trying to make to them this week. You know, if you guys won't even step up and send a few minesweepers, we're not asking you to put boots on the ground. We're not asking you to send fighter jets into combat. We're asking you to help us escort your own oil, just your own oil. That's all we're asking. And you're saying no? Well, go get your own oil. I mean, he literally said that yesterday, which I just think is hilarious. And the Telegraph interviewed him yesterday, and he told the Telegraph reporter, yeah, we're absolutely considering pulling out of NATO. You guys aren't serious, and we're not going to be part of an alliance that we're the only force present. So we'll see some interesting discussions over the next few weeks. As far as the price of oil generally, people have forgotten that the price of oil is artificially high and has been for your entire lifetime and nearly all of mine, because Iran has been threatening the Strait of Hormuz since 1979. So you've got a built-in risk premium to the global price of oil, which is a global market. Let's be clear about that. You have different prices in West Texas and Brent and so forth, but it's basically a global market. That price is needlessly elevated because Iran is sitting there threatening the strait day after day for 47 years. When you take that off the board, not only are oil prices going to come back down to where they were in February, they're going to drop below that. And that may be a 6-month to 18-month process, but I think we aren't looking at $75 oil. We're probably looking at more like $55 oil a year, year and a half out, and that being a pretty stable number because most of the bad actors that can affect the oil price will have been taken off the board. So that's all encouraging. And as far as regime change, nobody can know. But I can tell you what we're doing. For the last 2 weeks, we and the Israelis have been hitting individual IRGC thugs in the streets of major Iranian cities. These are the guys putting up roadblocks, and if you look like a protester, they kill you or arrest you. And some of those people got beaten over the head with clubs, sent to the hospital, and the IRGC guys go to the hospital and shoot them dead in their hospital bed. I mean, this is really horrifying stuff. They murdered 40,000 unarmed people in 2 days in January. So what we're doing, because Trump doesn't want boots on the ground. I mean, I could imagine taking Karg Island. I could imagine taking a couple of these little tiny islands in the Straits of Hormuz. Those are not big deals, and you're not going to face any meaningful opposition there because they can't get an army to those places. We've sunk their navy, so they're not going to be transporting 100,000 men to Karg Island. That doesn't work. But I don't think we're even going to do that. I think the reason we have the USS Boxer and the USS Tripoli in theater is for their aircraft carrier capacity. They can operate 20 F-35s each at will and do. And so with the USS Ford having had the kitchen fire and it had to go back to Crete for a couple of weeks for repairs and then it'll come back, you needed those ships in theater to be able to operate those F-35s. I don't think you're going to see boots on the ground, but if you do, it'll be very, very limited. Trump's plan is to get rid of the people who are murdering peaceful protesters in the street to such a degree that it's not safe, but safe enough for them to rise up and take back their own country. And likewise, these negotiations, we are trying to isolate parts of the regime from other parts of the regime. The regular army, you may have noticed, we haven't targeted the regular army at all. That, in Persian, that's the Artesh. We haven't targeted them. We've been going after the IRGC. That's the arm of the state. That, in German terms, that's, you know, the Wehrmacht versus the SS, you know, and we're going after the SS. And the idea is the Artesh has been there for, you know, 3,000 years. There's no reason that they could not come back and switch sides. I don't know. I know some of the guys at the CIA are really nonplussed by Reza Pahlavi, but his is the only name being chanted in the streets of Iran. And I think he ends up the head of a transitional government if they're able to overthrow the mullahs. And that is likely to be a really good thing. So my prediction on that would be, if Reza Pahlavi, who is the son of the Shah, Shah means king, if he is able to come back and lead a transitional government, this is a man who was educated in the United States. His children were educated in the United States. One of his daughters, who is the crown princess, actually is a venture capitalist in New York. These people are about as American as you can get. They come back into power, and you get the same scenario you got in the mid-1970s. When King Juan Carlos led the transition from Franco's dictatorship to a constitutional monarchy in a free country. And that would be a boon to the world. Iran has 90 million highly educated, highly entrepreneurial people in a nation that's enormous and has enormously more resources than just oil and gas. And if you turn that loose, it just enriches the whole world. And it's probably the best investment opportunity of the 2030s from an American perspective, too.
Gotcha. All right. So you're pretty optimistic about this and the outcome.
I am. I don't know if that'll happen. I mean, it's very possible that it won't because it depends on things that we can't control. But Trump is trying to set up the conditions for those things to happen. And that's really all we can do. I mean, we could invade, but come on, that's not going to work. That's insane.
What about the midterms? Because people are saying, I sound like Trump. Some voices online are saying, you know, this was the big mistake that Trump went into Iran. Now we're going to lose the midterms. You think we're going to lose the midterms?
I think we've got a really good chance, actually. We have a growing economic boom under the hood that is largely being missed in, you know, unending headlines about affordability. Where were those headlines when inflation was at 9.1% under Biden? Come on. You know, we've got $18 trillion in new investment into the United States from outside. Guess what? The entire U.S. economy is $30 trillion. You're talking about two-thirds the size of the American economy being invested into America from foreign sources instead of going out of America into foreign places. That's a sea change. How much of that gets here this year? Not all of it, but a good bit. So you're seeing a lot of factory growth. You're seeing a lot of positive construction area growth that will lead to staffing those places with skilled workers. A lot of the people who are currently fearing being displaced by AI are going to discover what a lot of analysts are beginning to see, which is AI is probably going to destroy about 70 million jobs, but it's going to create about 170 million. And what happens is you have a tool that can do a lot of your work for you, but what it can't be is creative, and it can't direct itself properly. It will go radically off track if there's not a human making sure that it does what it's supposed to do, and that's not going to change. You know, George Gilder's been talking about this for decades. Computation is not comprehension. This is still a fancy calculator. And so the human element is needed. And what it means for me personally is I'm about five times more productive than I was 24 months ago because I can use AI to do things that took me hours or days and have it done in minutes. And it's just transformative. So I think we are on the cusp of a huge economic boom. If that happens, we probably win the midterms. And the other, and of course, we're going to win this war in Iran. I really believe we are. I think we mostly already have. I think that will suddenly become a lot more popular. And, you know, victory tends to do that. And when you add all those things together, plus, I think the Supreme Court is about to get rid of racial gerrymandering. That's a 21 House seat boost to the Democrats for no good reason. There are over 60 Black members of Congress, and only one-third of them are in a racially gerrymandered district. Don't tell me that Americans won't vote for Black representatives. It's just not true. So that goes away. The Democrats don't get that 20 seats just given to them. And I think you're going to see some significant shifts based on tightening up voting restrictions. The executive order this morning on mail-in ballots is good. We'll see how it does in court, but I think we've got a good shot with that. And, of course, a lot of states have really cleaned up their voter rolls and really done good things in this direction. We had a lot more election fraud in Florida 8 years ago or 20 years ago than we do today, and it all matters. At the margin, it all counts, and I think ultimately we've got at least a 50-50 shot, and I'm slightly more optimistic than that. I might say 51 or 52 of winning the midterms. I don't think we lose them. We could, and that would be terrible, but I think we're in this ball game.
You said rare earths earlier aren't going to be a problem. You think we're getting Greenland soon?
One way or another, that looks a little different depending on how this NATO argument goes. I mean, we're not going to go conquer Greenland. That's not the thing. But how willing Donald Trump is to play hardball definitely depends on how cooperative the Europeans are. I think we can solve the Greenland problem with some sovereign base areas that are not dissimilar to what the UK has in Cyprus. I think we can come to an agreement that pretty well cuts the Chinese and Russians out of that territory. I think that's good enough. However, if I'm a Greenlander, I'm looking at this a little bit different. And some of them are just mad because they've got press owned by Denmark and it's just beating on the president all the time. But if you go to Nuuk, and I haven't been, but I have a lot of friends who have in the last year. If you go to Nuuk, there are an awful lot of Make America Great Again hats and a lot of American flags. And the thinking is very simple. Denmark treats them terribly. Denmark was doing forced sterilizations of native women as late as the 1990s. Denmark
I did not know that. Wow.
Denmark is a terrible colonial overlord. They backed off that and some of their more repressive stuff in the 90s, and they granted Greenland the right to vote for its own independence. They haven't, but it's not because they want to be part of Denmark. It's because they can't afford to be independent. Well, if you entered into a compact of free association with the United States, like we have with the independent sovereign nations of Palau and the Marshall Islands, and there's one other that I'm forgetting at the moment. You know, these are independent countries who can't afford to be independent. So we manage their foreign policy. We have bases in their territory, and they don't have to pay for embassies and state dinners and stuff. And they're free to do whatever they want. This is perfect for Greenland. And there's no question that an investment boom from the United States, which Denmark is not capable of under any circumstances, would transform the economy of the 57,000 people who live there.
Amazing. I'm curious about that myself because of the rare earth stuff. But man, if Trump, he already did the Venezuela's thing. If he does the Greenland thing, that's pretty incredible.
Well, and on rare earths, just to hit a few highlights, the Ukraine deal is centered around the rare earths thing. And Americans are so used to us just being a charity and we just give things away and we never ask for anything in return. That's a stupid way to run the world. Nothing works that way. Nike would go out of business if it did business that way. But Nike is a blessing to the world. They make good shoes. And I'm happy that they exist, even if they don't agree with me on politics or theology. They do good stuff. Tyson Foods does good stuff, but they don't do it for free. And the United States shouldn't have to. So the Ukraine deal involves rare earths. It'll also involve a lot of other things because there's no way to get to that deal without a peace. And the peace will involve rehabilitating Russia, which also has the effect of splitting it off from China, not entirely, but to a great degree, to the degree that we find manageable. And we also have this rare earths deal with Australia and rare earth deals in Southeast Asia. And we're starting to build refining plants in the United States. That's the real bottleneck. We can actually mine enough rare earths in the United States to supply 85% of the world's needs, not just ours, the world's. What we can't do is refine it. 92% of the refining capacity is in China. So the biggest story here is building refineries in the United States, primarily Texas right now, but also Australia and eventually Ukraine, possibly Greenland.
Let's switch gears and talk about the SBC. Do you think that Willie Rice is going to be the next president of the Southern Baptist Convention in June?
Well, I think he ought to be. I mean, there's no question. You know, this is the only major SBC leader I know who has publicly repented for his past sins. They just don't do that. They all pretend that, oh, woke? What was that? I didn't have anything to do with that. You know, Willie Rice comes out. And he had been on the wrong side. And it was what I was telling you about years ago. You know, it's not that he was woke. It's that his friends were woke. And most of them weren't really woke either. They're just listening to Russell Moore and these guys, and they're kind of imbibing of that. And there's nobody arguing with them. So Willie is preaching this stuff that, you know, frankly, is pretty terrible. But then he woke up one day and said, you know what? My friends are wrong. And he did a bunch of public appearances a few years ago, came out and said, I was wrong. Everything I said was wrong. I repent. This is what's true. They're preaching something that's anti-biblical. This is where I am now. Well, that's not a good way to move up in the SBC system. It just isn't. But Willie is one of those important pastors that got, you know, akin to all of those big church pastors in the 80s who got on side with the conservative resurgence, the Adrian Rogerses, the Charles Stanleys. Willie isn't maybe at Adrian and Charles level, but he's up there. And you know, honestly, demographics and logistics help Willie. Willie's in Clearwater, and the convention's in Orlando. So I think we've got a decent shot at turning people out there for him. But I have to say, our current president is good. He's not perfect, but he's good. He could not have happened several years ago without some Herculean effort on our part. And you'll recall, we nearly elected Mike Stone. We came within 300 votes of that after doubling turnout at the SBC. It can be done. We just didn't quite get it done. And yet things are trending in the right direction. So if Willie can win this, appointments are going to be really solid. It takes a little while for that to trickle down. And you know, the minimum time to change out a board of trustees of an SBC entity is about 5 years. The resurgence did it in 12. That is a while. And a president is only going to be president for a year or two. So his appointments by themselves don't necessarily translate to everything we'd like, but they start the process. And we actually just had 2 good years of appointments, not great, but good. So that's 4. And I'm pretty excited about that direction. Everybody has realized that wokeness was a mistake. And the people who didn't realize that have left, like Russell Moore.
Yeah, it seems to me that last year was the first year in a long time they didn't do any resolution on racial matters at all. Like every year, there was always a resolution until last year. ERLC is in disarray. They still don't. If they know what's going to happen, they haven't rolled it out publicly yet because I don't think they even have they don't have a president yet or anything.
They just announced a presidential candidate.
Did they? I missed that.
And he's okay. I mean, we'll see what he does in office. I was really disappointed in Jeff Orge at the EC. You know, he was actually a pretty good guy as president at a seminary in California. Used to be Golden Gate. Now it's Gateway because they had to move out of Marin County. But, you know, he was pretty good. And we had Conservative Baptist Network guys who were senior in his administration, and he let them go do whatever they wanted to do. And he did not give them trouble. He didn't fire them. You know, so we're pretty excited about that. And then he goes to Nashville and he works for the people he works for. The EC is dominated by leftists at this point. Mm-hmm. And there's just no getting around it. There are some very good people there, but they're in the minority. So Jeff has been a bit of a disappointment. We'll see what this ERLC guy does. The interim guy is good. So that's a sea change. We haven't had a good one since before Russell. And you know, these things start to add up. And I've been telling you from the beginning, the issue here is the difference, and this is arcane, this is inside baseball, but it matters. There are 2 different kinds of nonprofits in American law. There are nonprofits that are membership organizations, and there are nonprofits that have self-perpetuating boards. Harvard has a self-perpetuating board. Baylor has a self-perpetuating board. Whoever's on that board is going to pick their own successors, so they're going to stay leftist forever, and you're not going to have a say. In a membership organization like the National Rifle Association, or wait for it, the Southern Baptist Convention, if enough people show up and vote for the right people, they can change the organization. That is the benefit of the SBC institutions. I'd probably be like some of our friends and just say walk away if that feature didn't exist. But the truth is, the Baptist in the pew is still extremely conservative, and the leadership not so much. And if the Baptist in the pew ever wakes up and goes and does something about it, like they almost did in Nashville in 21, then you get change. And we saw that in the decade of the 80s. So I think it's important. Our SBC seminaries educate 1/3 of the seminary students on this continent. They don't graduate 1/3 of the preachers, but they educate, you know, a lot of people are there for other things. We have a lot of influence on other denominations. So it's really important that these institutions remain faithful. And I was talking on the cross politic thing last night about this one point that we must understand. 100 years ago, the liberals captured the Presbyterian Church USA, and their flagship seminary was Princeton Seminary. Machen was defrocked, went out and started the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and started Westminster Seminary, which is a perfectly good seminary even now. Guess what? Princeton Seminary still has more students than Westminster after a century. So Southern and Southeastern and Midwestern, they're not going away. The only question is who's going to control them. And I want it to be biblical, Orthodox, believing Christians.
Amen. Well, we're doing our part here, Conversations That Matter, to try to shed light, especially on the female pastor issue. I've been doing a lot of exposure on that. And I think people need to realize there's still a problem here in the SBC. It's not like it went away. There's still many churches with female pastors. And even the one I exposed yesterday was a NAM plant. And it's on the website, front page of the website, that they are planted by the North American Mission Board Send Network. And here they have all these ministers on staff that preach on Sunday morning service, endorsements from the senior pastor about women pastors. So this is an issue. You can't bring all of these various examples to the convention every year because there's too many of them. So I'm hoping we can keep the pressure on and we can see some real change in the Southern Baptist Convention. I don't know if people are tired of fighting or the online algorithms have changed. It seems to me like the debate that was there is not as heated or intense right now, but maybe that just presents an opportunity for us. If we can get our act together, if Southern Baptists will actually show up and vote, that would be a wonderful thing.
So. But we have a president right now who supported the law amendment. You know,
right.
he's good on this issue. Willie would be even better. And so I think we'll actually have some constitutional progress on that in the next few years, if Willie wins in particular. You know, the truth is all these movements have to be led by somebody. And Mike Law did a phenomenal job on this. Tom Askell, a bunch of these guys, and just love them. They did good work and we won. You know, we didn't win, but we won. We had overwhelming majorities for the law amendment both times. But, you know, a 63% in New Orleans. But it wasn't quite enough because you got to do it with 2/3. And the people on the platform were just dead set against it. Well, the platform's getting better. So I think we've got a shot at coming back at this in the next few years if we don't screw it up, which we usually do. But, but you know, maybe it'll be better. I actually think we've got a shot. And I think things are moving in the right direction, because the other thing that has happened is that a decent number of the churches that are transgressing here are also leaving the SBC. And that's a healthy thing. I mean, I should not be a member of an organization that I don't mostly agree with, and neither should they. I mean, we should have some integrity about that. And I am in agreement with the Baptist Faith and Message. I'm in agreement with the mission of the SBC entities, even when I disagree with some of them pretty strongly on some very specific things. But you know, I wouldn't join the Communist Party. I'm not going to join a Muslim mosque. That's stupid. Right. I don't agree with them. They're not with me and I with them. So why would a church that doesn't believe fundamental, basic Southern Baptist doctrine want to be part of the SBC? And you know the answer. You know, they want to become the majority.
That's right. Well, Rod, I probably got to end it because I got another appointment coming up in 2 minutes, but I really appreciate your time. And I might call this the white pill with Rod Martin, because you're so optimistic and we need a little touch of that. So if people want to check out what you have going on, rodmartin.org and the Substacks there, social media links, investment opportunities. And we really appreciate you making your time, because you are on a lot of other platforms that probably bring a lot more benefit to you, but you've stop by the Conversations That Matter podcast to even talk about things like the Southern Baptist, which I know you're probably not getting calls from Fox News to talk about. So we appreciate it. Thank you.
John, your conversations always matter, and I'm always happy to do anything with you.
All right. Well, God bless, Rod. I'll talk to you later.
And bye. You.